And we're just about to get back together after lunch, Bruce. And who are we going to hear from?
As soon as we get the witness list, we will find out who we're going to hear from. We're going to hear from Gregory P. Taylor, who was on watch at the Vessel Traffic Service Center in Valdez, the Coast Guard radar tracker, who was on watch when the Exxon Valdez ran aground. And he'll be the next one who's going to be up. Also this afternoon, we'll hear from another one of the vessel controllers, the one who was on from midnight to 8 in the morning. And we'll hear from Mike Pete, a toxicologist, and we expect to hear from him on things like blood alcohol level and Captain Hazelwood state, things of that nature.
I guess the testing, it's been disclosed this morning that there were several different sets of testing for alcohol and drugs among the crew of the Exxon Valdez. I guess two different sets. And so we'll hear more about that. This morning we heard mostly from the crew, as I understand it, and didn't really get much of the Coast Guard yet.
Well, we did have Lieutenant Falkenstein, who was the first Coast Guard officer, one of the first two Coast Guard officers to be on the ship. And we're now swearing in the witness. Let's go to the hearings.
Could you state your full name, please?
Gordon P. Taylor.
And who is your employer?
Department of Transportation.
Can you be more specific? Where are you employed?
I work at the Marine Safety Office in Valdez. Mm-hmm.
And what is your position, job title?
Vessel Traffic Watchstander.
All right, sir. Mr. Johnson will... Just one moment, please.
He'll be quizzed by Mr. Richard Johnson of the technical panel. A little quiet consultation going on at the head table. But they are staying on time, Bruce. They are pretty well sticking to schedule. And they had a little quiet meeting this afternoon before they came back to the room right after lunch here to discuss what they call procedural matters.
The way this entire hearing has been organized is that you have members of the safety board itself, you have a technical panel of safety board investigators and their consultants, and then there are four parties to this investigation. Alyeska, Exxon, and
Mr. Taylor can hear me right.
And the Coast Guard.
Okay, here we go.
Mr. Taylor, how long have you been a vessel traffic controller?
Approximately 2 years.
When were you hired by the Coast Guard?
I believe it was in August of 87.
Were you a vessel traffic controller prior to that time?
I was stationed in MSO Valdez from 79 to 84, and I was in the vessel traffic system as a watchstander for about 2.5 years.
What is the total amount of time you've had service as a vessel traffic controller?
4.5 years.
Would you please describe the training that is required in order to become a vessel traffic controller in Valdez?
Describe the training.
The training that you had to go through. I'm making reference to the check trips aboard the tankers, the examinations.
We take tanker rides to become familiar with the area. We do familiarization chartlets, and then we have rules of the road. Questions that you're asked.
Is that an open book examination?
Pretty much. Really not open book. You can find your answers if you want.
How many familiarization trips are you required to take?
Required to take two per year, I believe. One deep draft vessel and one tug ride.
I was making reference to your initial qualifications.
When you're initially qualifying,
how many trips did you have to make?
I'm not sure.
And you're required to requalify every year, is that correct?
That's my understanding.
And in order to requalify, what do you have to do? One trip on a
deep draft vessel and one tug ride. And that's pretty much it for the rides.
Are these rides mandatory?
From what I understand, yes.
Have you taken any of these requalification rides since you were rehired by the Coast Guard?
I believe I've only taken one since I've been rehired by the Coast Guard.
And when was that?
Approximately 1 year ago. I can't tell you exactly when.
Who establishes the standards for requalification?
I have no idea.
Is it in the VTC operations manual? Are the requirements there?
For requalification?
For requalification.
I believe they are. I can't quote them for you.
Who told you that you needed to take these trips in order to requalify?
Nobody told me that I needed to take any trips in order to requalify. It's just in the vessel traffic manual that you have to take a requalification trip every year.
So it's a practice and policy of the commanding officer of MSO Valdez that the VTC watchstanders must take these qualification trips every year?
You'll have to check with the commanding officer on that one.
Do you believe that these requalifying trips provide a useful purpose?
They do for people who haven't been in the area or not familiar with the area. They do, or haven't been on tankers. I believe that they help a lot. For the people who've been there before and go out there fishing all the time, I really don't see a whole lot of use for them, no.
Do you have any prior experience aboard tankers?
Yes, I do. I was a gauger for a third party called Caleb Brett. We're bulk liquid surveyors, and we go over to the terminal and assess the amount of oil on their vessel before they leave, as well as when they arrive. I did that for approximately 2.5 years.
Would you describe your duties and responsibilities as a controller for Prince William Sound?
My duties and responsibilities as a vessel traffic watchstander up in the vessel traffic center, is that what you're asking?
That's
me?
Correct.
My main duties is to talk to the tankers and make sure that everything goes smoothly. However, I do talk to them on the radio, of course, and make sure that they check in at their specific checkpoints, tell them what's going on, if there's any outbound or inbound traffic, any aids of navigation that are inoperative, and let them know ice, what the situation is at the time.
Do you plot vessels within the vessel traffic area?
Yes, I do.
Could you describe that, please?
The only place where I've plotted them really is in the Narrows. That's where it's mandatory that we do plot them through the Narrows. I acquire them with the radar, and it reads out a range, bearing, and speed. Excuse me. And once I've acquired the vessel on the radar, then I punch in a series of numbers on the radar screen, which activates a data logger, which records their bearing speed and the time. And then we just keep an eyeball on them.
For a vessel departing Alyeska Terminal for the Gulf of Alaska, when would you start plotting this? When would you turn the data logger on?
I'd turn it on approximately 1 mile prior to the vessel's arrival at the one-way zone, the Valdez Narrows. in that area.
What is the purpose of the data logger?
It's to record the range, bearing, and times of the particular vessel at a particular time.
Is it the main reason for just providing historical data?
Well, that's one of the reasons. The reason is just what I stated earlier.
Do you have any other collateral duties at the VTC that you perform while on watch?
We gather the weather for the weather office. We answer the phones. That would be other duties.
Are you permitted to leave the vessel traffic center while you're on watch?
For short periods of time, yes, to get your food, go to the bathroom and such.
And Exhibit 2C, Figure 2, there is a diagram of the vessel traffic center. Would you please... he can go up and look at the one that the large poster up there, but the one in the book is not labeled. And would you please describe the equipment, their function, and starting from the left and work your way to the right, please.
Okay, this is our communications tape recorder. It records anything said over a 13-16, whatever is transpires over a certain amount of or a certain number of our radios. And so it records everything. I don't know exactly how many.
Gordon Taylor is now standing in front of a large photograph of the Coast Guard Traffic Center. He's describing all the various instruments and pieces of equipment, what they do, and what the layout of the center is.
This is another radar here. I believe this is one. I believe this is two. I believe this is number three radar. Number three radar. It says here it's a slave radar to this number one here. Number one and number three radars are usually kept on the Potato Point site. And this is our data logger up above number three here. And this is a logger that records the times, the ranges and bearings to the particular vessel. this is a radio. It really serves no purpose up there. This machinery below it, you can punch in these keys to put any one of these radars anywhere you want. When I say that, I mean that you could take this Potato Point radar, number three, and make it into the Valdez spit sight radar if you wanted to, just by keying up the number of buttons here. This is our radio console for the radar watch standards here. And that's what we talk to the tankers through this. And this, like I say, this is our radar number one, our radar number two. This one's usually, number two is usually set on the Valdez spit side. And these usually keep this one on 12 mile, and this one on 6 mile, or if I have to switch down, I put this one on the six and this one on the three. It really depends on how you do that. It's also up to the...
Mr. Taylor, when you say this one's on 6 mile and 12 mile, will you tell us which radars... For example, radar number one is on, as opposed to just pointing and then seeing what the distances are?
I don't understand what you mean here. This, if I have this vessel, usually myself, I'm speaking for myself when it goes out. If a tank vessel's outbound, I'll keep this vessel or this radar screen probably on 12 mile screen.
Okay, so that's radar number one, master radar. Is that?
Yeah.
I'm trying to identify it.
Okay, the master radar I'll keep on 12-mile scale, I'll keep the slave on 6, or I'll keep the master radar on 6-mile scale so I can put the slave to 3. Usually I'll keep a scale up so you can see farther ahead. And that's really about it for this side here for my job, on this side here, we have the radio watch standards communication console. And all he does, well, not all he does, but he takes the radio traffic messages for the station, does response to emergencies, sends out the weather and stuff like that. What else?
I'd like to just go over what you just said in order to clarify it in everybody's mind. This is a Raytheon radar, is that correct?
That's correct.
How long has it been installed in Valdez?
I wasn't there when they installed it, so I don't know. I can't really tell you exactly when. A few years, yes.
When you're monitoring the Narrows, which radar are you using?
Usually when I monitor the radar, the Narrows, I use the master radar number one and the slave radar number three.
What's the difference between a slave radar and a master radar? Will you elaborate on that, please?
Okay, a slave radar is a slave to the master, meaning that if you do anything, if the master goes down or you do anything to the master, it's going to immediately affect the slave because it's nothing more than a slave to number one.
What radar is used to monitor the Port Valdez area?
Usually use the master radar number two to keep hold of Port Valdez. That's usually, but like I say, you can change it over to whatever you like. You can change the port to any monitor you want. But usually, it'll be on number two. Number one and the slave radar number three will be for the Narrows and the arm.
The communication console, could you describe that in greater detail as far as the number of sites in Prince William Sound? Is that totally separate from the other communication console?
No, it is not. The other console is the, I wouldn't say the master, but they can overkey you at any time they want. They can override you with their console. They can override any channel you have punched up. You cannot do that to them. The sites we have are the Valdez site, the Potato Point site, the Naked Island site, and the Cape Hinchinbrook site. Those are my sites. The traffic watch standard sites that he uses most of the time, going from left to right.
How is the video signal transmitted from the potato site and the spit site to the radars in the VTC?
I have no idea.
When you were a vessel traffic controller prior to 1984, what type of equipment was in the VTC?
Okay, we had different radars at that time. I believe they were AIL radars. I don't know what that means. The only thing I know is they were different radars, and they had more power. And that was they weren't as fancy as these ones, as the existing radars we have now. When I say fancy, they didn't do as much. You had to do everything manually as far as taking a plot, finding a range and bearing of a vessel.
If we were to do a side-by-side comparison between the Raytheon unit and the AAL radar, how would you judge the maintenance downtime between the two?
I can't really remember exactly the maintenance time or downtime on the old radars. These radars do fine for what they're designed to do, and from what I understand, that is watching the tankers through the Narrows for that. They work quite well. Downtime, I couldn't tell you that. You'd have to check with the technicians on that.
You said the Raytheon unit does a good job as far as the job it's designed to do. And does it work very well outside of the Narrows?
It, depending on the weather, it can be to where it works quite well, to where it works not well at all. As far as I'm concerned now, I'm not an electrician or nothing. I'm just a radar watch stand.
I know you're not an electrician, but you do operate the radar. Are you able to pick up vessels in the vicinity of Bly Island?
On occasion, yes.
With the Raytheon system?
Yes.
On occasion, what do you mean?
Depending on the weather, depending on how well the gear is working at the time.
What kind of weather would you have to have in order to pick up vessels off Platte Island?
I would say good weather, no rain squalls, no heavy seas, wind, stuff like that. It'd have to be good weather. And then the radar's got to be tuned up, working fine.
Can you estimate how many days a year in Prince William Sound those conditions exist?
No, I really, my estimation would be just that, an estimation. I really don't know. By saying a lot, that wouldn't help you. You know, we have bad weather up there a lot. I couldn't give you an estimation on that, no.
Can you recall, prior to the day of the accident, when you last picked up targets off Platte Island?
No, I can't recall when I last picked up a target down there. You can see stuff down there by looking on the chart. You would know that was an island, but by looking at the radar, you couldn't tell if that was what it was, to tell you the truth.
As a watchstander, do you commonly monitor the Valdez arm?
Yes.
Could you elaborate a little further, please?
When you say monitor the arm, I watch vessels coming up through the arm or going down through the arm, usually as far as I can.
How far is that?
On the average, it's probably from 7 to 13 miles.
Under what circumstances do you monitor vessels in the arm?
Under what circumstances?
Do you monitor them as a standard operating procedure?
Yes, I do.
All the time?
Yes, I do.
What range scale do you use?
I use a 6 mile. Usually that goes out offset to approximately 10 miles, and then I'll switch over to 12. The 12 mile scale on the radar, and that'll take me down even farther.
Could you describe the offset feature on the Raytheon radar, please?
Well, the offset feature, like if you had 6 mile scale, you're only going to see 6 miles from the center of the screen out, as I understand it. The offset will move the center of the screen up to one corner of whichever particular portion of that you want to see, up, down, left, or right, and you can offset it, push a button, offset your radar up to that particular point. You can offset on a 6 mile roughly to 10 mile scale.
So when you monitor the narrows, you have the master radar on the 6 mile scale?
Usually I have it on the 12 mile scale. Well, let's see, when I do the narrows, is that what the question was? When I monitor the trying to track a vessel going out through the narrows, I usually have the master on the 6 mile scale, and I usually have the slave on the 3 mile scale.
How many targets can a Raytheon radar acquire and track?
I'm not sure exactly. I'm somewhere in the vicinity of 15 to 20, I believe, something like that.
Is the radar particularly sensitive to weather conditions in general?
Yes, it is.
Can you elaborate on that, please?
Rain squalls, it picks up rain squalls quite well, and picks up waves, the seas, very well. When I say it picks them up, it shows what looks like a large amount of contacts down there, down on the screen. And your squalls going through just looks like a rain squall going across the screen. It's hard to explain.
Are wind-generated waves considered a common occurrence as far as sea clutter is concerned?
Wind-generated waves? I would say yes.
Have you had any problems plotting vessels in the narrows because of rain or sea clutter?
They have, on occasion, because of the rain or sea clutter, the vessel or the radar would not track, would not hold my target. It would take off. When I say take off, it would just jump off the outbound vessel and just do its thing. What it's actually doing, I believe, is searching for something to acquire. And if it doesn't go back to that vessel, then it'll take off up the side of the mountain, and you'll just have to reacquire the vessel or the target.
Is this when you're using a Potato Point site?
Yes.
So what are you saying is that on occasion, when there are rain or sea squalls, rain or snow squalls or sea conditions, on occasion you will have difficulty plotting vessels that may be within 2 to 4 miles of Potato Point, is that correct?
Difficulty plotting them, no. Difficulty holding them, keeping them acquired on my radar, yes. I can always do a manual through that area. I can do a manual plot, which is usually what I'll do if I can't hold them. But I just reacquire them, and it seems to work out.
Describe how you would go about making a manual plot.
Well, we have we just have to push a button, and it gives you a heading, a bearing from Potato Point, and it gives you a bearing line. You put that bearing line on your whatever you want to put it on, and then you just run your little trackball out to where to however far you want to, and it will get right there on the radar. It will give you a range and bearing.
What do you do with that information?
Well, if I had to take that information and it wasn't coming up on the data logger, then I would put it on the log.
What is the use of this information on the data log? Do you plot it on any type of chart?
Usually we don't. If everything goes fine, we don't. We just keep it with the vessel's data sheet. And then if anybody has any questions arising about it, they can go back and replot it.
So therefore, the data logger is used primarily as a historical record for any type of violations within the Narrows. Is that a correct characterization?
Yeah, it's used as a it's used for historical data. Yes.
If you don't plot the position of the vessel, how do you know exactly where it's located within the Narrows?
Well, we have an optimum track line on the radar screen that comes up. You can key that in with a certain amount of numbers onto a small board, and it will come up with an optimum track line. Lines across at the start of the Narrows and at the say top of the Narrows, bottom of the Narrows, and there'll be an optimum track line through there. We watch the vessels, and they're supposed to stay on the optimum track line or close to the optimum track line, and that's how we tell exactly where they're at.
Is there a requirement for vessels to stay on that optimum track line, or is it voluntary?
There is a I understand there is a requirement for them to stay on the optimum track line. And if they get outside 150 yards, I guess it's a leeway for the optimum track line, then we're to call them up and tell them that my radar holds you or finds you 150 yards, right or left the track, please take corrective action.
And the information on the data log is used to substantiate that?
Yes.
Are there any penalties imposed for going off the optimum track line?
I don't know.
Would you consider this a common occurrence?
Of going off the optimum track?
Yes.
No, I would not consider it.
When a vessel leaves the Narrows and is heading towards the Gulf of Alaska, how do you maintain control over the position of the vessel in the Valdez Arm?
How do I maintain control over
the
position?
How do you monitor?
Visual monitor.
How do you know what part of the Valdez Arm, just by, you used the term earlier, eyeballing, is that correct?
I used that earlier, yes.
When the vessel enters the traffic separation scheme in the vicinity of Rocky Point, how do you determine whether a vessel is in the southbound lane or the northbound lane?
Well, there's a set of track lines down farther too that pick up approximately just below the Rocky Point area, extending down past Bly Reef, that you can key up also on the radars, which shows a dotted line for the traffic separation scheme, the northbound and southbound lanes. You can key those up also.
Do you key them up every time you monitor the Valdez arm?
No, not every time.
Would you say you use those lines on a frequent basis or infrequent basis?
On a frequent basis.
On a frequent basis. During our earlier interview with MSO Valdez, you made a comment regarding the performance of the Raytheon unit. You stated that the radar was, on the day of the accident, working as well as it could, and that, in your opinion, the radar could be tuned up better. Would you care to elaborate on that, please?
Well, that was my opinion. I'm not an electronic technician, nor am I a radar tuner. I just thought that when I had the gain turned all the way up to see a vessel, that the gear could be stronger.
So did you have a problem picking up vessels as a result?
Yes, I did.
Would you care to describe some examples?
Well, one example would be it wouldn't show on the radar. A vessel would not. The radar would take a sweep, and then a vessel would be there. Then it would take another sweep. The vessel would not be there. It would take another sweep. The vessel would not be there again. And then another sweep. The vessel would be there.
And how far would the vessel be away from Potato Point?
Oh, I couldn't tell you on that, Denny. I don't know, really.
You're stating that you've had problems maintaining contacts with vessels in the Valdez arm because of what you perceive to be a tuning problem. How far away from Potato Point were these vessels before you started having a problem holding
on
to?
Sometimes six to 7 miles. Sometimes it wouldn't start dropping off until they were down to 10 or 12 miles. That's south.
Is this what the radar run the 6 mile scale?
Yeah.
An offset?
Right. And then that's with the radar on offset, 210 miles. Now I'd have to go to 12 mile scale. If the vessel is still showing good on my 6 mile, I'll switch it over to the 12 mile scale and watch it even farther down. And that's how I would know that it was dropping off the 12 mile.
Mr. Taylor, is it possible to monitor the Valdez Narrows and the Valdez arm at the same time prior to the accident?
Yes. When you say monitor, I would say that to see both of them at the same time. Is that what you're asking me?
I'm talking about plotting as well as monitoring.
For plotting, I would say no. You'd have to have your master radar would have to be on 6 mile scale in order for me to get a good 3 mile scale reading for the narrows. When a vessel comes through the narrows, we keep it on the 3 mile scale. For plotting purposes, it shows a better picture, a larger picture.
Is traffic within the Valdez arm one way, or does it go both ways?
In the arm, it can go both ways. In the narrows, it's designed one-way traffic there.
If a vessel was approaching the narrows and another on a northbound approaching the narrows and another vessel was southbound heading for the Gulf of Alaska, what would be your priority?
Well, it's a first come, first served basis usually. The first vessel that checks in, it's a rocky point before a vessel gives me a time or a vessel is off the dock at Valdez, they're probably going to get the clearance for the one-way zone because they got there first. However, if they both get underway, if there's a vessel sitting at Rocky Point and there's a vessel that just pulled away from the dock, usually I'll let the pilots figure it out because it doesn't make any difference to me who goes first, but the pilots have a better idea of how they'd like to do their timing. So I like to let them make up their minds over that. And usually it's worked for me.
So the scheduling of vessels entering, leaving port is left up to the pilots in Alyeska?
No, it is not left up to the pilots in Alyeska. When a vessel gets underway, first, if there's a vessel at Rocky Point, there's a vessel that just got underway, roughly their times are going to be the same for entering the Narrows. So that at that time, I usually would ask the pilots how they'd like to work it, because it doesn't matter to me which vessel goes through first, as long as only one goes through at a time.
What vessels are required to participate in the Prince William Sound VTS?
Oh, tank vessels, larger tank vessels, tugs, towing or pushing astern, floating dredging, floating dredges or plants, any vessel over 100 tons, carrying passengers for hire.
Is it possible for vessels to enter the traffic separation scheme without the VTC knowing about it?
Yes. Yes, it is possible.
Will you describe the process of vessels entering Prince William Sound and how the Coast Guard would monitor them?
Entering the sound would only be a, we monitor them only by radar, or excuse me, radio. And any vessel that has to participate in the Coast Guard vessel traffic system would give me a call, depending on which way they're coming from. If they're coming into Prince William Sound from the Gulf, a tank vessel would give me a call 3 hours out to let me know they're there. Then they'd give me another preliminary call 1 hour out, and then they'd call me at Cape Hinchinbrook. And at that time, they'd give me an ETA to Naked Island, and they'd call me at Naked Island, and they'd call me at the pilot station. And at that time, I would give them clearance for the one-way zone. And they'd call me again at Entrance Island, and call me when they're alongside the dock. That's inbound. That's how it generally usually happens.
The vessels, you would not know the location of the vessels unless they chose to participate. Is that correct?
Yes. That's usually, that's the way I understand it. The only way I can figure it out is they give me ETAs, you know, to each specific point, check-in point. The only way I would know that they weren't doing what they were told is to, if they don't check in, call them and find out what's going on.
Would you please describe to us the events that occurred from when you went on watch on the 23rd of March until you were relieved by Mr. Blanford later that evening?
I was on watch for 8 hours. I don't know exactly what went on the entire 8 hours to give you a chronological events of what went on my entire 8 hours. I can't do that, no.
Did you receive any ICE reports during the course of your watch?
Yes, I did. I received it from a vessel that went through earlier. I believe it was the Arco Juno, approximately 4 hours earlier, outbound also.
Did you receive any reports from the Bartlett?
I don't remember offhand. I remember the Bartlett came up through afterwards. I don't remember.
Did you pick up any ice on your radar at all that evening?
No, I did not.
Could you describe what the ice conditions were that were reported from the Arco Juno?
Yes, the Arco Juno reported there was ice extending from Point Fremantle over almost to Bligh Reef Buoy, almost to Beam Bligh Reef Buoy. And it was extending, comes out Point Fremantle, across to Bligh Reef, down to Bullhead, I believe it was, another point, which would make it sort of a cone, a pointed cone coming out of the Columbia Bay there up towards Bligh Reef Buoy.
Is this considered a common occurrence?
Yes, it is.
What type of actions did the Arco Juno have to take?
They had to deviate out of the southbound lanes over into the northbound lanes. I believe they said they had just a small area of open water to get through, and I believe that was between Bligh Reef Buoy and the lanes. that they went down through.
Did these ice conditions concern you in any way? Were you concerned about this ice condition?
Yes.
Does the port have a, does the VTS have a policy of limiting transits as a result of ice discovered in Valdez Arm?
Not that I know of, and if it gets totally blocked in there, I'm sure that they'd have one for that. But for the just the ice coming out of there, not that I know of, no.
You stated that you were aware of the ice because the Arco Juno reported it.
Right.
Did you plot the Arco Juno outbound that evening?
I can't recall if I did or not. I did plot them out through the narrows as far as a manual plot, say by acquiring them and having that recorded with our data logger. But when they got farther down by the Bly Reef area, I don't believe I did.
Even on the 12th, you just can't remember whether you plotted it, or you can't remember whether you monitored it at all?
I can remember monitoring it, yes. However, I lost, from what I recall, I lost it on my radar somewhere at the 10 to 12 mile range.
Did you observe the vessel alter course into the northbound lane at that point?
The Arco Juno?
Yes.
Yes, I did.
I'd like you to describe the events as they occurred from the time that the Arco Exxon Valdez, the pilot at Exxon Valdez gave his pre-departure call and until you were relieved by Mr. Blanford.
Okay, approximately 2100, the evening of the vessel got underway, the 23rd, I believe. I got a call, a pre-call from the vessel giving me the particulars of the vessel, drafts, destination. They told me also if everything, the ship was in good working order, ready for sea in all respects. I said, Roger that, be waiting your call and underway. And that was a half hour pre-call. So I got the call at about approximately 21:26 that the vessel was underway. They gave me an ETA for the narrows, approximately 30 to 40 minutes later. And I cleared them for the narrows at that time. And then I didn't hear, I don't believe I heard anything from them again until they were about 10 minutes from the narrows, from entering the one-way zone outbound. And I believe at that time the pilot asked me for an ice report. I told him that the Arco Juno had went down there earlier and reported ice coming out of the, from the glacier, from Point Fremantle extending over to Bly Reef Buoy. And next they went through the narrows with no problems, and I got a call at Potato Point by the pilot saying that they were at Potato Point and they were going to increase speed. And the next call I got was down at Rocky Point, and that was from the vessel. It was telling me that the pilot was disembarked and that they were heading south. I believe, I don't know if it was, who I was talking to, I thought it was the third mate at the time. However, now I don't know who I was talking to. It was just the vessel saying that, judging by their radar, there was a large concentration of ice down in the Bly Reef area, and they'd get back to me if they had to do any deviations through the ice and such. And then approximately 10 minutes went by again from that time, and I received another call from the vessel saying that he sees a lot of ice, they're gonna have to wind their way down through the ice, and he was going to course 200 at 12 knots. And he would wind his way through the ice and get me a new ETA to Naked Island and an updated ice report.
What time did Mr. Blanford arrive at the station?
I believe he arrived at approximately 23:30 that evening, 11:30 that evening.
And what were you doing at that time?
At that time, I was getting the watch ready to be relieved, making sure the paperwork was up, everything was in order.
Was any of the communication sites out that evening?
Yes, they were. The Cape Hinchinbrook site was, I believe, in op, not working. And we were having problems with the Naked Island site also, I believe, in that you couldn't transmit out on them.
Could you run down the sequence of events, logbook entries that you make, as you prepare to turn the watch over, Mr. Blanford, starting from 23:30.
Well, I didn't make any logbook entries. I just went back over all the logs to make sure that they were in order. When I say in order, when a vessel gets underway from the port, then you log the time it left, where it's going, its ETA to the next port, and you make sure that's done. And I have to do that on, I believe, three different pieces of paper, three different logs. I put the time underway. So I went back to make sure that all that was in order, and that the logbook I've written down that I was on watch from 16 to 2400. I put down my name on watch. And I just made sure all that was in order.
What time did the Exxon Valdez call you regarding their course changes?
I don't really recall exactly what time it was. Comes to mind about 23:30. I believe it was just before Skip arrived.
During our earlier interview, you stated that when the Exxon Valdez said they were altering course to 200, that you walked over to the status board. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
What did you do?
I took the sticker of the Exxon Valdez. It's the name of the vessel is really all it is. It's a magnetic sticker, and we have a large map of the entire sound, and I put it where the vessel was and where it was going. So what I did is I set it up on the chart, and I cocked it at approximately 200.
How did you know where the vessel was?
I could see them on radar at that time. They were just slightly south of Rocky Point.
Do you have the ability to plot on the status board?
Yes, I do. If I
could you describe how you would plot on the status board?
Well,
I don't understand.
Well, generally, as a rule, you don't plot on the status board. Okay. If I had to, I could, because it's just a large chart. You can plot on it if you have a mind to.
How large is this status board?
I would say it's roughly 6 to 7 feet tall by 8 feet wide.
It's still not clear to me how you would plot on an 8x7 chart. What tools would you use?
There's not a whole lot of tools you could use. What I'm saying is, if you gave me a longitude and a latitude, I could go up to that chart and tell you where that was at.
And what happened next?
After Skip came in?
Yes.
I relayed what was going on. I said all the paperwork was up. I had two vessels inbound, and one was an hour out from Cape Hinchinbrook, and another one was approximately an hour behind the vessel, 2 hours out from Cape Hinchinbrook. Then I told them that the Exxon Valdez was outbound. They were going down through the ice, deviating across the lanes, and they would call him when they wound their way down through there. They would give him a call with an updated ETA and an updated ice report.
During our early interview, you made reference to the fact that vessels traveling through the Valdez Arm are, on a usual term, are eyeballed, and that anybody up there can look at the thing that is qualified and has been doing it for a while and tell you whether they're in or out of the lane. Is that a fair estimation, how you monitor the vessels?
I can do it. I believe I can do it. I don't know about anybody else. But I think that I could, you could go up there and I could probably show you in a short period of time. And you could also do it, anybody could.
Okay, so the Exxon Valdez at altered course to 200, you still had them on the radar, is that correct?
Right.
And Mr. Blanford had arrived at the station?
No, not yet.
Well, could you please describe the interaction between you and Mr. Blanford prior to you being relieved from then on?
Okay, the vessel called me. I don't know, I can't remember exactly what time they called me, but it was prior to Mr. Blanford's arrival and told me that they were going to 200 at 12 knots. I rogered that. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Blanford arrived. And I gave him the particulars of the watch, what was happening. I told him the tank vessel Exxon Valdez was outbound. They were 200, 12 knots. They'd call him when they got through the ice with an ETA to Naked Island and an updated ice report. I also relayed to him that there were two inbound vessels, one hour out from Cape Hinchinbrook, one 2 hours out from Cape Hinchinbrook.
And what time was that?
Approximately between 23:30 and 23:45 that this went on.